The Guardian.
Hello, it's Wednesday, May the 7th, 2008. I'm Andy Duckworth. On today's podcast, another week, another battleground. This time, Obama and Clinton are fighting it out over Indiana and North Carolina. The death toll continues to rise in Burma, with bureaucracy slowing down the aid effort.
The death toll and the number of missing has increased dramatically again.
Wendy Alexander breaks ranks with Labour over Scotland breaking away from the UK. All this as the Work and Pensions Secretary tells The Guardian how the party's trying to fight back.
What Tony Blair did in the 90s was about transforming our policy, then rebrand the way that it was communicated.
But first, a summary of the day's main news and a review of the papers with Sandy Waugh.
In Burma, the UN says that it has reached the first of the cyclone victims with food and other supplies. Well over 20,000 people are reported to have died, with more than 40,000 missing. An estimated 1 million have been left homeless 5 days after the storm. Many aid agencies say they still have not been given permission to enter the country, and in Rangoon, food prices are said to have doubled. More from our correspondent later in the programme. In the United States, Hillary Clinton has not made the crucial breakthrough in the latest Democratic primaries. Senator Barack Obama clearly won North Carolina, but lost Indiana by a small margin. That means that Obama hasn't forced out Clinton either, and she pledged last night to fight on through to the National Convention. We'll hear the full story from our US correspondent shortly. There are more political troubles for Prime Minister Gordon Brown from his home north of the Scottish border. Already in political trouble over the lost seats in the local elections, now he's in open disagreement with the leader of Scottish Labour. Wendy Alexander, a close political ally, has called for a referendum on Scottish independence, but she admitted that she did it in defiance of Mr Brown, as we'll hear later in Guardian Daily. The Independent Police Complaints Commission is investigating the shooting of a man in central London by police. It's believed to be the first such shooting in London for 3 years. A siege began after armed police were called to Chelsea because a gunman was reported to be shooting at passers-by. Surrounding buildings had to be evacuated, and a police negotiator attempted to make contact. But late in the evening, more shooting was heard from the flat, and it was later announced that the man had been killed. Well, that's the story in some of the morning papers, called by The Sun, a shootout on the King's Road. The Burmese cyclone disasters on most front pages, though, as are the PM's political troubles. The Telegraph says that British drivers are paying an extra £600 tax a year, while the Mail says that prices mean that families have less to spend than for 17 years. And the Times reports an opinion poll that says 55% of Labour voters want Brown to resign. The Express pulls it all together, saying that Brown has been warned by his cabinet that the country is being taxed to the limit. More on the day's news plus breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
Indiana and North Carolina have been to the polls in the latest contest for the Democratic presidential hopefuls Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Both candidates have been showing signs of fatigue, and after 16 months of campaigning, who can blame them? Suzanne Goldenberg from The Guardian's team in the U.S. reports.
It was not a good night for Hillary Clinton. She did manage to squeak out a victory in Indiana, but she suffered a crushing defeat to Barack Obama in North Carolina. Together, what these results mean is that she still is very far behind Obama in the race for delegates. Indeed, she slipped even further behind with tonight's results. But more importantly than that, she has failed to really demonstrate that she can turn this race around. It had seemed in the closing days of this campaign that Clinton really could turn the situation to her advantage. Barack Obama had perhaps the worst week of his campaign for the White House. He was being buffeted by a controversy about his association with his Chicago pastor, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. He was also on the defensive because of Hillary Clinton's proposal to cut the tax on petrol over the summer, which she argued proved that she cared more about working people. But even though the news wasn't going in Barack Obama's direction and the opinion polls suggested a very tight contest for him in North Carolina and a rather comfortable win for Clinton in Indiana on the night. Indeed, what we have seen is Clinton just barely managing to hang on in Indiana and Obama doing rather well in North Carolina. What this means is that he is strengthened as he goes forwards in the six remaining primary contests, and Hillary Clinton is going to have trouble making the argument to Democratic officials, the superdelegates, that she really is more electable, and she's also going to have a lot of trouble raising money, and that could be the thing that finally sinks her campaign.
Suzanne Goldenberg. And for more analysis, go to guardian.co.uk/America. Aid deliveries to cyclone-hit areas of Burma are being hampered by travel and visa difficulties. It's estimated 1 million people have been left homeless, with the official death toll increasing all the time. The EU Humanitarian Office says destruction is close to 100% in some communities. Many aid workers are still waiting for their visas to get into the country, and the devastation means roads are in poor shape and telephone lines are down. Gordon Brown is promising Britain will do everything possible to ease the suffering, with George Bush calling on Burma's military junta to allow the US to provide disaster assistance. Ian McKinnon is following developments for The Guardian from nearby Thailand.
Well, the latest developments are that the death toll and the number of missing has increased dramatically again. It started off very low over the weekend after the cyclone hit Rangoon and the southwest of the country on Friday night and Saturday. And for several days, there was very little word of damage and particularly the number of dead or missing.
Why such a high death toll? Can you explain to our listeners why so many people were killed?
It seems a particular problem. The area worst affected is the Irrawaddy Delta, which is a very low-lying area to the south and southwest of the main city, Rangoon. When you look at it on a map, it's many, many inlets of water from the sea, from the Bay of Bengal, and the whole area is very low-lying. So the problem with the cyclone was that the winds of 120 miles an hour whipped up huge seas, a storm surge of at least 12 feet and possibly up to 20, some people say. And this brought a huge amount of water inland over this very low-lying area, where also the problem, people live in flimsy bamboo houses, which were either blown away or swept away over a huge area. There are 7 million people that live in this delta alone.
So it was almost like a tsunami in effect.
To some extent, yes, it was huge. People say that once the floodwaters receded, either many villages were just gone along the coast, and the whole area and what remained was just covered in mud.
Sure, swept away, as you say. So what are the most pressing needs now?
Aid agencies are still desperately trying to get to the area to assess the scale of the damage. There are quite a number of towns where there have been really no reports have been received from them so far.
And what do you read into the government's admission here? Because as you know, the regime is sometimes suspicious of outside interference.
It is suspicious of outside interference and particularly international aid agencies. It seems at this time that even they have realised that the magnitude of this problem is overwhelming for a government that's already patchy at best. And they do seem to acknowledge that they need outside help. I think the terms of reference are still being debated in meetings with aid agencies and government ministries in the country at the moment, and it remains to be seen. Obviously, the aid agencies want to get their workers, their international workers, and their relief supplies in as quickly as possible. But that seems to be still taking some time at the moment, despite a willingness by some in the government to do that. Those aid agencies who are working on the ground say that they are being able to move quite freely. So that's one positive in this.
Sure. Now, after the initial impact, the people being swept away, what are the main dangers now?
The main dangers, the aid agencies are extremely concerned that there is a lack of shelter. Some believe that as many as a million people might be homeless at the moment. There's also there's very little clean drinking water. And so the fear very much is of waterborne diseases among the survivors. After that, of course, they need food and they need things like mosquito nets because of the very tropical climate and the onset of the rainy season at the moment.
Ian McKinnon speaking to Jim Falzerano. And for the latest information, click on guardian.co.uk/world. Elsewhere on The Guardian's website today, there's analysis as the price of oil reaches a new high, guardian.co.uk/money. In the environment section, John Vidal writes on Britain being woefully unprepared for the floods. Guardian.co.uk/science looks at NASA's next big mission, ROC-200-SG-344. The scientists now want to land a probe on an asteroid. Plus, has a chubby Aussie swimmer been dropped from the Olympics? Guardian.co.uk/sport. Downing Street is backing away from supporting a referendum on Scottish independence. It's after two of Gordon Brown's closest allies north of the border appeared to support nationalist demands for a vote on splitting up the UK. Scottish Labour leader Wendy Alexander and her brother Douglas, the International Development Secretary, say they are unafraid of the proposed vote despite previously opposing independence. From our studio in the Scottish Parliament, The Guardian's Severin Carrell tells us it's causing huge controversy.
Well, out of the blue, Wendy Alexander, the Scottish Labour Party leader, has told the Scottish public and her own party that she now believes that the Labour Party in Scotland should be supporting the SNP's attempts to have a referendum on the independence of Scotland. And this is something which has effectively come out in a series of interviews she's given to the media rather than through any deliberate policy announcement at a Labour Party event or press briefing.
And she's obviously changed her mind on this, hasn't she?
She has indicated this afternoon at finally having a press conference to discuss her new policy on this, that she believes that the SNP are dragging their heels and appear to be running scared. She claims to have detected evidence that the leader of the Scottish National Party, Alex Salmond, is starting to attempt to delay and postpone having the vote in 2010. And it's her belief that actually she reckons the Labour Party will be able to capitalise on that by challenging him to come forward with the vote and to get it over and done with.
So Wendy Alexander says she's unafraid of the verdict of the Scottish people. Is she unafraid of Gordon Brown by doing this, do you think?
She's made clear that she sees this as an issue of her integrity and her independence, if you like, as Scottish Labour Party leader, that she has to be seen to be leading from the front, taking decisions which appear to be unpopular, but are actually, she claims, in the best interests of the Scottish people and of the Scottish Labour Party. In a sense, she has indicated that she doesn't necessarily think that Gordon Brown's unhappiness about this is as important as her showing that she's leading from the front and challenging the SNP. It's a question, if you like, of her showing that she's got muscle and the guts to take on the SNP. Some people might regard this as Gordon Brown losing even more authority over other parts of his party. And certainly the Tory and Liberal Democrat parties up here are absolutely furious about it, and the only party which appears publicly to be happy about it is the Scottish National Party. And for a lot of people inside the Labour government and the Labour Party as a whole, this isn't an ideal position to find the Scottish Labour Party in. One thing that Wendy said today, which she believes underlines and highlights why this is the correct tactic to pursue, was that she says that in 1996, when she was an advisor and speechwriter to Donald Dewar, the then leader of the Scottish Labour Party, she was the only person publicly to say that the Scotland Act, which would be coming in once Labour won power to set up the Scottish Parliament, ought to be put to the Scottish people in a referendum. She said then it was a deeply unpopular position. It was unpopular with the Labour Party. It was unpopular with the Liberal Democrats and the Tories. But eventually, everybody came round. She says eventually, Tony Blair himself took a unilateral decision to set up this referendum without necessarily consulting his colleagues. And history has shown that this was the correct decision. It was a courageous decision. It was a brave decision. So in a sense, what she's doing now, she says, is in keeping with that way of leading from the front. It might be unpopular now, but in future, it'll be seen to be the correct thing to do.
Severin Carrell. So as the Labour Party is being ripped apart from all quarters, one man's been formulating a plan to keep us all together. Work and Pension Secretary James Pennell is determined to win the battle of ideas with the Tories. Our chief political correspondent Nicholas Watt spoke to him after a speech to the Fabian Society on child poverty.
There's a big difference between now and the mid-90s, and that difference is in the mid-90s people just gave up on the Tories. They just decided their ideas were wrong, they had the wrong answers for the country. Was actually, when I was talking to people during the election, the questions that they're asking are questions to which Labour has really good answers to. In fact, I would say better answers than the Tories. You know, they're saying, what can you do to help me and my family more? What can you do to give Britain a good economic future? What can you do more for public services? Those are questions which Labour has better answers to than the Tories. And for me, that's the sort of the fundamental reason why we should be confident in fighting back against after the results last week.
But is this not a change moment? I mean, it was very interesting in The Guardian. Polly Toynbee had a column praising your speech, saying very good, but basically saying this is a change moment and this government looks like a beached whale.
Yeah, I mean, I like one bit of Polly's article more than the other bit. I think she's been too pessimistic on the big debate about ideas, because actually I think, you know, the ideas are going in a progressive direction. You look at the election in America, you know, all of the candidates moving in a progressive direction. You look at the debate here, the Tories having to come onto our ground. And, you know, clearly those were, you know, as I said in my speech, it was a grim night, it was a grim weekend. But actually, we need to get up off the floor, we need to fight back, because we have got the ideas on our side. And, you know, that very fact of having shifted the ideological centre of gravity is something that should give us confidence and move on to the next set of ideas, you know, set the Tories a new challenge.
But doesn't this look like a government that's not really in control? In your speech, you said that Gordon Brown can be proud that his one defining mission is to tackle poverty, is to help the less well-off. And yet he abolished the 10p tax rate in his last budget as Chancellor. It hit 5.3 million households and is now hitting the Labour Party.
Well, actually, that budget also helped the poorest families in society. And, you know, the budgets and pre-budget reports of the last year and a bit will mean another 500,000 children coming out of poverty. So I think, you know, we've accepted that we made a mistake in not sort of acting this year once the economic circumstances have changed to help certain groups. But the fundamental point is all the parties agree the 10p rate had to go. Everyone agrees it was the right thing to do short term to get help to the poorest early on in this government. But actually, tax credits are a much better way of helping people in the long term. So on the ideas, no one's really disagreeing with us. You know, there's been a discussion about the politics of it, but on the ideas, none of the other parties are saying what they would do. And that's because of this fundamental thing, you know, the gap between putting out press releases and doing policy. And on policy, I think the Tories are now going to face a much sterner test than they have in the last few months.
You used to work in Downing Street with Tony Blair. When you look at David Cameron, do you see the Tony Blair there of the mid-1990s? He looks like a very good Prime Minister in waiting, doesn't he?
He doesn't, actually. And for that very simple point, that what Tony Blair did in the 90s was about transforming our policy so that you could then rebrand the way that it was communicated. And what the Tories have done is learnt one lesson, but not the full one. They've learnt that they need to rebrand themselves, not that they need to change their policies. And that is the chasm in which we're going to try to, you know, place our campaigning in the next few months.
James Pennell speaking to The Guardian's Nicholas Watt. I'm Andy Duckworth. Still ahead in today's Guardian Daily, coming to a TV screen near you, we look at the latest revolution in broadcasting. So is it finally time to splash out on that HD TV?
ITV don't have any HD services at the moment. This will be their first foray into HD. BBC and Channel 4 have started to make moves in that direction and make more of their programmes available in HD.
But first, East Asia's biggest rivals are preparing to welcome a warm spring to replace the bitter winter chill that has long weathered their relationship. Hu Jintao has arrived in Tokyo on the first visit to Japan by a Chinese president for a decade. Over the next 5 days, Hu will meet the Japanese Prime Minister and dine with the Emperor and Empress. The Guardian's Justin McCurry is in Tokyo. I asked him whether this is the beginning of a beautiful new relationship between the two countries.
Well, I think that the thaw really began in late 2006 when the then Prime Minister Shinzo Abe visited China very soon after he was made Prime Minister. That really set this whole reconciliation, if you like, in motion. What Hu Jintao and the current Japanese Prime Minister Yasuo Fukuda will be talking about over the coming 5 days will centre on a whole host of issues. Not many people expect there to be any concrete agreements, but just the very fact that the two men are talking and that that President Hu is happy to spend so long in Japan is a real sign of progress. They'll touch on some of the issues that continue to divide the two countries. They'll talk about their competing claims for natural gas deposits in the East China Sea, about global warming, obviously with the G8 summit in Japan just a couple of months down the line. They'll be keen to show a united front in terms of committing themselves to halving greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. Talk about economic ties. Japan is now China's largest trading partner, overtaking the United States last year. So they'll want to build on the huge amount of trade between the two nations, and trade that Hu Jintao said only a couple of days ago has brought massive benefits to people in both countries.
Do we think they're going to be talking about Tibet at any length, and maybe the Olympics will get a mention as well?
Well, Japan's been fairly muted in its criticism of China's crackdown on protests in Tibet, certainly compared with European countries. Although Mr. Fukuda did say quite recently that he thought that Tibet was a genuine international issue, my guess is that given that China has started talks with representatives of the Dalai Lama over last weekend, a feeling in Japan that it would be impolitic of Mr. Fukuda to embarrass his guest, certainly publicly. I doubt very much whether there'll be much detailed discussion on the Tibet issue. There could be a mention of human rights abuses in China in a final communique, but that's also obviously a very sensitive subject. As far as the Japanese press are concerned, that subject is still being negotiated by officials from both sides.
And finally, Justin, also on the agenda, I understand, poison dumplings, ping pong and ling ling.
Yes, we'll take the ping pong first. If there's time, Mr. Fukuda and President Hu will try and resurrect the ping pong diplomacy between the US and China of the early 1970s and have a gentle game of table tennis. They'll also be talking about dumplings. Earlier this year, a shipment of frozen dumplings from China that arrived in Japan was found to contain pesticide, poisoning dozens of people and also hitting Chinese food exports to Japan. And last but not least, Ling Ling. Ling Ling was a panda who lived in Ueno Zoo in Tokyo. She was a gift from China to Japan in 1992. She died of heart failure last month. This act of nature means that pandas, as well as ping pong, are now on the agenda for Mr. Fukuda and President Hu this week. The hope is that Mr. Hu will agree to loan or even give Japan a replacement for Ling Ling, much to the delight of Japanese school children.
In today's Football Weekly, the Premier League, tighter than a pair of soccer shorts as Chelsea and United take it to the wire, while at the bottom, Fulham continue the greatest Cottagers comeback since George Michael. Elsewhere, quality football is back at Eastland as Zenit St. Petersburg make it to the UEFA Cup final. There's title news from Spain, Germany, France and Italy, plus the World Cup for countries that don't exist. All that plus the drama of the final day in the Championship in Football Weekly. For details, go to guardian.co.uk/football.
Finally for today, a new satellite TV service has been launched in the UK. It's different to Sky because once you buy it, there's nothing else to pay. FreeSat is non-subscription and has more than 80 TV and radio channels at the moment. That number's expected to rise to 200 by the end of this year. It's available to 98% of homes. Here's our media correspondent, Owen Gibson.
So the best way to think about FreeSat is as a satellite version of Freeview, which is the service that many people probably know about, where you go to a high street retailer, you take home a box, plug it into your telly and the aerial, and you get 40 odd channels on your television. FreeSat is a version of that, but instead of your existing aerial, you'll receive them through a satellite dish. There'll be more channels, so you'll get up to 200 by the end of the year, and you'll also be able to get high definition channels much sooner than you'd be able to through Freeview. So it's free to air television for a one-off fee, and it'll expand the range of channels that you have available to you.
So why do we need this?
Well, there's two reasons. Some people living in an area at the moment where they can't get Freeview. There's about 25% of households who live outside the Freeview transmission area. So at the moment, their only choice is if they want to see digital television or multi-channel television is to subscribe to Sky, or confusingly to get the free-to-air service from Sky, which they've also called FreeSat, which has been up and running for a number of years, but obviously they haven't promoted it very heavily because they want you to pay. So so basically the upshot is, yes, if you're outside a free view area, then you'll want it, or if you're keen on getting high definition broadcasts and you don't want to subscribe to Sky, you'll also be keen as well.
Because at the moment you can only get HD through Sky, isn't that right?
Sky offer it, and so do Virgin Media, which is the cable service, but at the moment broadly you have to pay for it, that's right.
Okay, so who's behind this, and is it giving Sky a run for its money?
So BBC and ITV are behind it. They're the joint shareholders. They'll both put money into the marketing of this thing and running the call centres and that sort of thing. They're running it along the same model as Freeview. So basically the manufacturers are responsible for making the boxes and the satellite dishes. The retailers are responsible for installing them. But BBC and ITV will sort of play an overall guiding role. It's not really in direct competition to Sky. Obviously, it's not a pay service. But it's definitely one of the motivations is definitely for BBC and ITV to have an element of control over their own digital destiny, if you like. They both, you know, they both don't want to cede that control to Sky, so they're launching their own sort of parallel service that allow them to retain more control over it.
At the moment, do ITV have any HD services?
ITV don't have any HD services at the moment. This will be their first foray into HD. BBC and Channel 4 have started to make moves in that direction and make more of their programmes available in HD. ITV said today they were going to do the same, which has immediately sparked a big row with Sky, because ITV said that their HD programmes would only be available for the moment through this new FreeSat service. And if you're a Sky HD subscriber, you wouldn't be able to see them, which obviously didn't make Sky very happy, and probably will spark a war of words between the two, but also will spark commercial negotiations between the two. I mean, I think ultimately ITV will also show their programmes on Sky, but they're waiting for Sky to stump up some cash for them to do so.
Haven't we been through all this between Virgin and Sky and the consumer losing out in the end?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, anyone who's paid close attention to these things down the years will certainly have an element of Groundhog Day about this. These sort of rows between broadcasters and platform operators are common. And ultimately, yes, I think you're right. I think in this situation, Sky are probably quite right to turn around and say, well, it's our subscribers that lose out at the end of the day if they can't see ITV in high definition. And actually, in those homes, people may watch a bit less ITV, so it's in the interest of both parties to come to an agreement, and I think they'll probably do so much more quickly than they did in the case of Virgin and Sky, which kind of escalated until neither side wants to back down.
Owen Gibson. That's it for today's edition of Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's will be available to download from 7:30 a.m. Producing today, Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey. I'm Andy Duckworth. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.